The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 219 on 9/21/2009.
Greetings, folks. So, John, that's a bunch of nines, a bunch of twos, a couple of zeros, and a one thrown in for good measure, all mixed up to form this week's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. How are you?
Fantastic. Yeah, there was a bunch of weird things. There was 999 that happened kind of recently. So yeah, some people get excited about that.
Yeah, fun with numbers. But that's not where we're going with tonight's show.
We're not having fun with numbers.
Well, we don't know, actually. You know, we've got this agenda here, but it's so loosely indicative of what it is we're actually going to wind up talking about. But it often gives us a start. In fact, maybe we should just dive right into the agenda with some cool stuff that you folks found. And John, you found some cool stuff, and then I found a tip of sorts.
Yeah, we all found cool stuff. The only thing I'll say in regard to numbers is somebody's going to have a number that's going to increase by one this week. That's all I'm going to say, Dave.
Well, I'm not sure what you're talking about. Can we
leave it as an exercise for the listener?
Pregnant pause. That's right. More fun with numbers, although it's not that much fun and really not related to numbers. But tomorrow, September 22nd, and I believe at 5:18 p.m. Eastern time, we officially shift over from summer to fall. All right. Well, it's okay. Nothing.
Yeah,
like
my heat's about to go on. So
yeah, I've got the heat on in the studio tonight. It's that strange season where
and a couple of the TMO staff, I believe, got snowed on today. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Colorado got hit.
Colorado. Yeah, that's right. All right. With some cool stuff found, Arun writes in and says, holding down the option key whilst the Apple menu is open will change the about this Mac to system profiler and remove the ellipses from sleep, restart, and shutdown options, as well as logout, meaning you don't get a confirmation dialog if you click on them. So this will work both in Leopard and Snow Leopard and probably even Tiger, but we don't have a Tiger machine to test it on here. But if you open up the Apple menu, hold down the option key, it will shift all five of those things, system profiler, sleep, shutdown, restart, and logout, which can be handy for launching system profiler. And though apparently it's been around for a long time, I'd never seen this, John. So did you know about this when Arun wrote in about it?
No, I try to, spend time just, hitting all the keys on all the menus to see what happens. But I missed that one.
I know. I'm surprised. I'm surprised neither one of us caught it, because that is the kind of thing that we would just try for no good reason. But well, anyway,
another one.
You got another one. Go ahead.
Yep, and this is thanks to Kelly, who is a listener and actually asked this on Twitter, but she sent out just a question saying, what's this thing in the upper right-hand corner of the Finder window, and how do I get to it? And I was wondering that myself, because I really don't use it too much. It's still candy-like like the other buttons, but it's clear, and it's more oval than circular.
More like a chiclet than a droplet.
Yes, but still shiny and candy-like. But apparently, at least in the Finder, that is called the Show Hide Toolbar button. And what it hides, which is kind of weird, it hides what you could call the toolbar in a Finder window, which is some of these, extra things that are not in the top menu bar, but are within the window itself. But Dave, you also notice, and I noticed this too, and this is kind of weird, it also gets rid of, what do you call
the sidebar.
Which is usually on the far left and shows, volumes, network connections, various important folders, search results. You can put a whole boatload of things there.
This is one of those cases where Apple breaks away from its own human interface guidelines, because in every other app that follows HIG, you will find that little chiclet thing only removes the toolbar, and any sidebars that exist do not go away when you hit that. But the Finder, apparently somebody decided, we got to just lump that sucker right in there. So that's what they did.
Yeah. And then I noticed too, and then she had replied, it does something else in other apps. And I'm like, really? And what it does is apparently this is built into the edit menu on pretty much any app where you edit things. But okay,
so now instead of talking about the chiclet, now you're talking about the keyboard shortcut that does the same thing, which is Command Option T, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
So it's kind of funny that there was an overlap. Well, not really, but it's just the same key sequence. All right. Well, we'll leave it at that. But it brings up something that to me is reminiscent of a pop chair, whatever you pronounce it. I say char because that's kind of programmer.
All right. Yeah.
But anyways, it brings up a menu where it shows you pretty much all the special characters, math, arrows, parens, currency, blah, blah, blah. Which you can then insert Braille. Oh, gosh. Look at this. Greek. So all sorts of great fun stuff here that you can paste into your apps if you don't know how to type it, which is usually a pain in the neck.
All right. Another cool thing found, Guy emailed me and was asking me, now that I'm in Snow Leopard, what am I using for multiple clipboards? And I had not found anything with which I was happy yet. I was a PTH pasteboard user, and then that's changed in Snow Leopard pretty fundamentally. And so I kind of refreshed and started a search, but Guy found a thing called Jump Cut, which the most recent version came out in January of this year, but it works fine with Snow Leopard and tends to work fairly well, and it's actually free. So so that's what I've been messing with now, but I can't imagine. And I only started using multiple clipboards maybe 2 years ago, probably even less. And now I can't imagine living without it. And by multiple clipboards, I mean a clipboard stack, so that it's a clipboard with memory and I can jump back and pick things from the stack at will. So it's very, very handy. So that's Jump Cut. And we'll send a link out to that.
As it should be. I think some apps, I don't know if Adobe or others, some apps do that, but yeah, it's not common.
No, I think Apple needs to build some of that functionality into the system. Just a history, a clipboard history. It's really not that big of a deal.
And, yeah, Unix and, you know,
yeah.
Even MS-DOS kind of have the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All right. You have an eSATA thing, which was a very long tail that we're going to try and compress down into the nugget of wisdom that we wish to share.
Yes. And so it's our buddy Duffy, and he was trying to build a RAID array and found something for his fairly new Mac that will give you eSATA ports. eSATA are SATA ports that are designed for external drives. So I got this kit. It's basically a cable extender, and it extended the ports that are on the motherboard of his machine. But he was having a problem because he'd fire up the machine, and just like, you know, any other external drive, you know, he'd plug it in and it would show up. And it's like, well, that's kind of weird. And then I read up a little bit and I just happened across the line in the product description, though I'm sure I found it elsewhere, that said, by the way, these are not hot swappable, which basically means that he was doing it in the reverse order. What he should have done, and this solved it, and actually I'm very surprised he didn't blow anything up, is to first turn on the drives. And if any of you have done work with SCSI or just other external arrays, sometimes you just got to do this. Though with things like USB and FireWire, you probably don't. I don't know. Your mileage may vary. So that solved the problem. You fired up the drives beforehand, plugged them in, and then turned on the machine and it saw them. So
yeah, so this is in the Mac Pro, the and I think it's a newer tech branded thing, which comes now from Otherworld Computing. And like you said, it just takes the eSATA port from the motherboard and essentially gives you, it's an extender, right? I mean, that's all it does. And it plugs into one of the slot covers on the back of the machine. But
well, I think it's a differently shaped, so there is a technical difference between a SATA port and an eSATA port, because the eSATA port, I think, is larger and keyed and stuff like that, and I'm not quite sure why they're different.
Okay.
But it did physically, when I saw close-ups, I don't know if, I wonder if my G5 has this.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It does look a little bit different. I'm looking at the thing, but you're right. It the machine still treats it as an internal device. In fact, Duffy was even saying that you can't, you don't get the little eject button like you do on FireWire or USB that are true external things. So, be very careful not to turn those off while the machine is on.
Yeah. So to me, the takeaway is, you know, if you're going to do anything, make sure the devices are powered up first.
Right. That's right.
I guess in, 2020 hindsight, that's kind of, you know, blazingly obvious, but
yeah, but it's not obvious. And it's the kind of thing that's very easy to forget. So we'll leave it at that. So once I installed 10.6.1, John, my machine got a lot less stable. I started having the OS itself was fine, but I started getting all kinds of app crashes. Safari would crash regularly. And these are, you know, built in apps to the OS.
I'm getting a lot of crashy McCrash a lot with Safari as well. And yep. He brings along his buddy Flash usually.
Yep. Yep. So I was having all kinds of problems with that, and it was driving me crazy. And so I did a little bit of maintenance last week, and I believe I've solved the problem. In fact, I know I've solved the problem. And I believe I know what I did that solved it. I did two things, but I believe it's the first thing that fixed it. I went and got a new version of Cocktail, which is a system maintenance utility like Onyx, which I'd gotten very attached to over the years, but at least at the time, and I don't think even now, I don't think Onyx has a Snow Leopard version. Cocktail did. I had a license for Cocktail anyway, so it was no big deal. I went down and updated Cocktail, and I ran it and cleaned all of my caches. Not my my browser history or my cookies or anything like that, but all my system caches and everything. And I let it totally wipe that out and then reboot the machine. And it's been fine since then. I also looked in the console log and saw it complaining a lot about a few of the things that are kind of held over in my /library/input managers folder. So I cleaned most of those out too. And then rebooted, and my machine has been very stable, but I don't think removing the input managers changed that. I think it was more the clearing of the caches that fixed my issue. So if you're having those problems, John, try that out. Try cleaning your caches with Cocktail, or if Onyx is Snow Leopard compatible yet, that would be also fine. I'm looking here.
Yeah,
there it is. They do. They've got a Snow Leopard beta that just came out yesterday. So now you can try that out too. So, anything else to add to that, John?
Nope.
No. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll go into our first sponsor for the show, which is Circus Ponies with Notebook version 3.0. You've heard us talk about this before. Notebook is an application that allows you to organize your thoughts on particular subjects, or projects that you're working on by creating either one or multiple electronic notebooks. You start out in hierarchical mode, similar to you get a notebook page on your screen that actually looks a lot like a paper bound notebook, and you start typing and you can tab in and kind of organize things in a hierarchy. And then you can pull in other data. You can pull in pictures. If you have a tablet, you can draw. You can pull in PDFs. You can OCR those PDFs so that you actually get at the text that's inside them. Or if the PDF already had text, you can get to that. You can OCR faxes or scans that you've pulled in. You can notate PDFs so that when you're in on that PDF, if you want to put a little note in there and say, oh, yeah, this is, you know, this file, or here's this user manual for this piece of software that I'm using for this project I'm working on, and here's this one piece that I want to highlight, you can do that. And then you can take all of these notebooks and you can search things across them, and you can search by keyword, by date entered, by text that you typed, pretty much any, whatever it is you remember about what you're looking for, you type that in and it'll seek you right to it. And this is all available at circusponies.com. It's $49.95 for a standard license, $29.95 for an academic license. $99.95 gets you a family pack, which gives you 3 user licenses. And if you are a Notebook 2 user, and my guess is most of you have already upgraded by now, but if you haven't, it's only $25 or $24.95. Of course, there's a free 30-day trial that you can get at circusponies.com. So go ahead and check it out. It's an app that's going to let you organize various things that you've got, kind of disparate pieces of data that are otherwise by unrelated by kind, but related by topic. And you can lump them together and pull them all together so that you can organize your thoughts and your life. Circus Ponies Notebook at circusponies.com. Should we go into Bill's syncing strategy here, John? I think it's,
yeah,
we skipped this one last week because we frankly didn't have time. But here, let me pull up
you
Bill.
Can distill the essence of it.
I'm going to try here. Okay. Bill writes, my question has to do with hooking up an iPhone for the first time to a new computer. My son-in-law has had an iPhone for over a year and has built up his contacts and calendar events. In addition, he's added apps from the App Store to his iPhone. He's connected to a separate account on an iMac he shares with our daughter and their two daughters. However, he rarely actually uses the iMac. His use is pretty much confined to the iPhone. So for the purpose of my question, let's pretend he has no Mac and now plans to purchase a new MacBook. And he does. That's not the pretending part. Okay, so the idea is he is concerned that he has all this data on his iPhone that he wants to migrate to a new Mac, but he doesn't necessarily want to. He doesn't want to use the migration assistant, and I'm not quite sure why. My first answer here, I'm trying to look. This is a very long email that, as John said, I'm trying to distill down. And, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and read it because I think we might be missing something here. So he says, I've done some Google searching and have come up with some advisories and recommendations since we know that when he hooks up his iPhone to the brand new Mac, iTunes is going to wipe out his contacts and calendar events. And I also assume any downloaded apps from the App Store, free or purchased. Common suggestions for the first two seem to be to enter at least one contact in the contact database and one event in iCal, and that will cause iTunes to sync those. No, all right, we're gonna skip all this. I know where we're going, John. All right,
I see a small tangent. So I think what he's assuming is that something's going to happen when you hook up an existing iPhone or iPod to a brand new machine.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Now, what's going to happen is it's going to offer to sync that data in two ways. Now, I would still highly recommend using the migration assistant. Take the MacBook, put it over on this machine, and copy over the data that you care about. You could also do it manually by going into library contacts, or home library contacts and home library calendars. And both of those, it's not contracts, sorry, it's home library calendars will get you your calendars. Home library, I think it's application support address book has all your address book data. Yes. So you could manually do it there. You can do it with migration assistant. I see no reason not to, especially if you've got the iMac there. But for the sake of argument, if you've got this data out there, you can choose to sync it back with your Mac. And it should not wipe this out. Now, it's always possible that it will, but the first thing that happens when you sync your iPhone is it does a backup of the iPhone, and that will have all that data in it. You also have all that data on the machine that you've synced from, that you previously synced to, which is the one that, which is the old iMac. So I think you're fine. And you also, once you've authenticated iTunes, you'll have the option of copying apps back too, but that might you might be right on it, wiping out apps. The good news is, although it's a bit of a tedious process, you can re-download all the apps because once you've purchased it, the App Store remembers your purchases and will let you re-download even purchased apps for free.
Yes. Yeah, I've done that even on my Touch sometimes, or yep. If I'm using a different device and the same app, they're like, oh, I know about this one already. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's going to wipe out your apps or not. I don't think it will. I think it'll let you pull them back because I've downloaded an app to my iPhone directly from the store, and then it syncs it back with my computer. And I would think that you're going to get the same thing if you start with a fresh version of iTunes as well. You got anything to add there, John?
I found an Apple support article maybe worth looking at as well, but it suggests that certain data can be synced in two directions. So to me, that would imply that you're not automatically going to wipe things out. And a link to it, it says contacts, calendars, notes, bookmarks are synced from or to your computer.
Right.
But it says other things like email account settings, music, movies, TV shows, podcasts, and photos are synced one way from computer to device.
Yeah, and that's right. The only thing that would be synced back is purchased music or purchased movies. Those you can sync from the iPod or iPhone back to the Mac, but anything else, you're right, you're going to lose. Now, again, the migration assistant would deal with this, and I would recommend that as the first path. If you don't want to use that, there are apps out there that will let you pull the the music data off an iPod or an iPhone. The most popular one and the one that I've had success with is an app called Senuti, S-E-N-U-T-I, and that is iTunes spelled backwards. Mm-hmm. And it does exactly what iTunes does, but backwards. It pulls the data from your iPod or iPhone back to your Mac. And I've had good luck with that. It pulls playlist data, everything. It rebuilds your iTunes library. So that's yet another option that I would use. But again, I don't see why in this instance, the migration assistant is being avoided. I think it is the easy answer here, especially for this type of data. But as an exercise in assuming that we can't use the migration assistant, this is how you do it. So anything to add there, John?
No.
All right. We're going to move to Sebastian here and see what he has to say.
Hello, John and Dave. I am a listener of the Mac Observer. You guys have helped me in the past. I absolutely love what you do for the Mac community. But enough about me and enough about you. Here's my issue. Having problems, I have a I'm trying to archive Final Cut Pro, Final Cut Studio, Leopard, and some other dual layer discs that I have. I'd rather, obviously, like most people, have a backup kit screwed up in the original. So I bought a spindle of dual layer DVD minus R, and I'm having problems making backup copies of Leopard, Snow Leopard, and like I said, various other, I'm sorry for repeating the same thing, various other dual layer discs that I have. And I was reaching out to you for some advice I have a G5 PowerPC and a early 2008 MacBook Pro. I have Toast, which I've been all over the internet. Basically, Toast does not properly support dual layer. I have Toast 8, Toast 9, Toast 10. Appears to be an issue. I tried Disk Utility on the G5 as well as on the MacBook Pro. Nothing is working. But I do know, if there's anyone who can help me, it's you two fair-feathered friends. Okay. You can email me.
Oh, we'll leave that. We'll cut him off there. Do you have a short answer here, John? Because I think I have the short answer, and I've been through this before.
Well, one, that's an older machine. I think you said a G5. Yes. One thing is I would go to a system profiler and look in the disk burning category and just see exactly what is supported or what the drive thinks it supports. I don't know if there's a firmware upgrade or something like that. So that's one thought.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a good thing because newer drives will support different things, and going to System Profiler will tell you exactly what kind of media. But
just to make sure, because I think there was a point where they would support the plus but not the minus and stuff. Now, I'm not saying... well, I'm saying maybe he doesn't know off the top of his head. No, he must have tried this before.
So yeah, yeah.
So, but, you know, double check it just to see what the drive thinks it supports.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I think that's a good idea. But with dual layer discs, this is more important than it is with any other kind of media that I've used, CDs or regular DVDs. You have to use high quality media. And sometimes that means paying three times as much per disc. But, you know, buying those spindles, you can buy cheap spindles and you can buy expensive spindles. And the one thing I've learned about cheap spindles is they don't work. I looked when I heard your message, Sebastian, I did some searching because I've used Toast and the only problems I've had are with cheap media. The rest of it, it's totally reliable. And sure enough, most of the posts that I read, it sounded like the rest of the people out there were having the same issue. It was, you know, look, if you get cheap media, that's it. Now, you can get away with cheap media for regular CDs. You can get away with cheap media for regular DVDs. In my experience, dual layer discs, you get what you pay for and you pay for what you get. So that's.
Or it could be. I've heard of isolated cases where, you know, it's something, you know, either there's some gunk on the lens or the laser is starting to die. It could be that.
I mean, absolutely.
They're not impervious to, you know, damage.
Right.
I don't think I've ever had, I think I've had ones that started getting picky. They would spit out the cheap stuff. I don't know if maybe I was reading too much into that, but
yeah. It could be. All right. Mark writes, I've got the wrong Mark right up in front of me. Oh, that's not good. Wait a minute. Did I not sync this up? Did you get Mark's email there, John? Cause yeah. I'm not finding it out in my Yojimbo here, which is odd, yeah. But I've got it. I pulled up the PDF here. All right. Good. So Mark writes, I'm hoping you can help me with an issue I'm having since upgrading to Snow Leopard. Any new photos I take and add to my iPhoto library do not show up in iTunes under the photos syncing section in my iPhone. The last photos that are visible in iTunes are from the 25th of August, which is the last sync prior to installing iPhoto. I have a feeling it is to do with my permissions, as I did a clean install and copied my library from a cloned copy of my hard drive. I'm also having problems when rotating photos in iPhoto as they rotate for a second, then they rotate back, but get stretched in the process, which makes me think it has to do with permissions. Please help. Mark from Edinburgh. All right. It could be a lot of things, but it sounds like it could be a permissions problem. So I would first try using Disk Utility to repair the permissions. It should go ahead and do that. Have you ever experienced anything like this with an iPhoto library, John?
No, I'm trying to find something. I'm going to iPhoto right now.
Okay.
But just a suggestion for probably a better way to do this. Or actually, no, I want to get the letter up here and see what he was doing. Was he copied my library from a clone copy? That concerns me that he's implying a library was copied.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like a library file instead of dragging the pictures.
Now you can copy iPhoto libraries around. I've done before.
Sorry, because I see there's an import command, which may be another way to go about this that I think would probably get around some permission issues.
Yeah,
file menu. Just saying.
Yeah. I mean, if he goes to Home Pictures, there should be an iPhoto library right there, and if you click on it and then do a file and get info, you should see permissions down at the bottom. If you twist open the sharing and permissions triangle, you should see that your user has read and write access. And if it doesn't, well, click on the little lock, authenticate yourself, and change it so that your user does. That would would be the first step.
iPhoto library. Okay, I have a folder here, as it turns out.
You have a folder called iPhoto library?
Yeah, well, that's because I'm running an older version on the G5.
Okay.
Actually, yeah, you're correct. No, it is a file. Okay, that's why I got confused, because I was seeing a folder. But still, there is an import command. Or actually, a lot of times you just take the pictures and drag them on top of the icon of the dock, and it doesn't import.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I think based on his email, he's seeing the pictures in iPhoto. He's just not seeing them in iTunes, which is trying to link it to his iPhone. So that tells me, if it were just that, I would think perhaps it's this iLife media browser issue, which it might still be, but his inability to rotate kind of indicates that maybe these pictures can't be changed. So, you know, there's the Mac OS has kind of behind the scenes what it calls its iPhoto or iLife media browser, which lets all of the different iLife apps see the data from the others, so that when you're in iMovie, you can see your songs from iTunes and your pictures from iPhoto and pull them all together and sort of vice versa. So there's a couple of things. First, there's a knowledge base article that talks about how to fix media browser issues. So if changing the permissions doesn't work, try this, and we'll put it's knowledge base article TS1192, but we'll put a link to that in the show notes. The second thing to try is reapplying the latest iLife media browser update, which we'll also put in the show notes. And then lastly, you can try deleting the com.apple.ilifemediabrowser.plist file, which is in your home library preferences folder. And hopefully before you get to that step, your problem will be solved. So that's
wow.
That's interesting. Yeah, but I bet you're right. I bet it's a permissions thing, and either running a permissions repair or simply going and changing the permissions on that file should do it. That would work for me. All right, you want to talk about John's ground hum here, John, or the okay. hum that we believe is a ground hum? All right, let me see if
okay, we agree on this.
Yes, that's right. Oh, it's good. John writes. A friend has a G5 tower, a new Mac Pro, a MacBook Pro, and a killer classic stereo system. As of a month ago, he could plug in either the G5 or the MacBook Pro to the stereo via a mini jack and get great sound from iTunes. Then something changed, and suddenly the G5 started generating an overpowering bass hum, but the MacBook Pro continues to work fine. The new Mac Pro also generates the same hum. I suspect it has something to do with the 60 hertz ground loop, but I don't know enough about this topic to give the friend a recommendation. Computers and stereo are plugged into the same circuit via grounded outlets. Three questions. What could have changed to cause the G5 to start to hum after years of working? Why does the MacBook Pro continue to work fine? And number three, what's the best way to eliminate the hum in this situation? All right, well, I think you and I, as we said, John, are in agreement with John here, who wrote in, that this low end hum is a ground hum. 60 hertz is the frequency at which our electrical system in this country oscillates, right?
Mm-hmm.
And 60 hertz is pretty low. It's not quite, you know, the thump you'll feel in your chest, but above that a little bit, but still a pretty low sound. So it is going to, we've all heard it. You know, if you pick up a phone that's not grounded mm-hmm. quite right or whatever, you get that, you know, kind of thing going on.
Now
question number one, he asked, what could have changed? Well, I'm reading the first sentence of his email. My friend has a G5 tower, a new Mac Pro, a MacBook Pro, and a stereo system. Do you think you know what changed, John? I think it's the Mac Pro. He says it's a new Mac Pro. And he talks about how previously the G5 and the MacBook Pro would be happy, and now they're not. I think it's the Mac Pro that has introduced this into the system. And it stands to reason. It's, you know, there's probably something out there that it's simply not happy about. The first thing I would do is try and isolate the Mac Pro on its own circuit, or at the very least shut it down and unplug it and see if the problem goes away. Once you've isolated where the issue is, then you can start to kind of look and say, okay, you know, what should we do, and how do we make it happy? And it could be a peripheral that's plugged into it that's causing this. It could be the Mac Pro itself. Hard to say. Any thoughts on that, John? See, because the MacBook Pro, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think around cables and seeing if that makes sense. I'm thinking some more.
All right, because the MacBook Pro is not the charger is grounded, but I don't believe the MacBook Pro itself is grounded. Right, it's isolated from ground by way of the charger. The charger gets the ground and then just sends signal. There's a transformer in there in the charger that sends power to the MacBook Pro, but does not ground it. So that would explain why, if there is some sort of ground disturbance happening, the MacBook Pro would not be affected by it, and you would not hear the hum from it. But the G5 is plugged directly into ground, and so the audio circuitry is getting that same hum. So I isolate that stuff off, and you may, you know, with the Mac Pro, you may have added a peripheral, but you know, the first thing to do, get the Mac Pro off the circuit, try it out. Is it working? Yes. Okay. Now start to introduce it, but don't put peripherals on it yet, you know, and one thing at a time, and see if you can find out where it is. And then you've just got to isolate that piece off. You know, you can't have it on the same ground loop. Can't have it plugged into the same power strip, you know, that'll do it.
Yeah, and I'm thinking sometimes these problems can involve, I mean, it could be a power cord, it could be an audio cord.
Chances are it's not the audio cord, right? Because if it's plugged into the MacBook Pro.
Right, it works. Okay, so no, it's not that.
But you're right. It could be a power cord. Yeah, absolutely could be a power cord.
Yeah, and they got those, you know, things that check your ground. You may just want to make sure your ground's okay. It may be good enough, you know, running, as you said, because the nature of the ground of the MacBook is a little different.
Right.
Right. Versus going to the case of the machine. So, or at least it's, you know, a direct power supply versus a, AC to DC converter.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. So hopefully
or chokes, that's kind of reaching. No worry. Yeah, we'll link to what chokes are. Chokes always help to filter out our weird noises.
That's not a bad idea. Actually, putting chokes on the cable going to the speakers, assuming the speakers themselves don't have a ground just from the system, then that would be it. And you're talking about like ferrite core chokes, right?
A lot of cables have them built in already, and their purpose is just to, I guess, smooth things out or absorb nastiness.
So what we're talking about here is you'll see these on some cables where the cable is actually looped through what looks like a little, thicker than what I would call a donut, but a cylindrical core, and you run the cable through it once, pull it back through, and then run it through again, That is, it's built out of a magnetic, or I guess out of ferrite, right? Typically, and usually that can help to dissipate some of that hum. I've used them in the car for iPod adapters for exactly the same thing. If you've got power plugged into one side of the iPod, and then you're plugging, you know, a mini 8 jack from the other side in, you can definitely sometimes get that weird hum because everything's kind of out of phase not out of phase, but you get too much running through it, and it tends to get mucked up, and using that core to dissipate it tends to help. That's a good idea. That, you know, it won't solve the problem. It won't tell you where the problem is, but it might address the symptom, and that may be all you care about. And that, frankly, may be all you're able to do anyway. So cool. All right. So Mark writes in, and this is actually a question that he says was, well, he said directed at John and Pete, but I think he meant me and Pete. And Pete's not here. Pete's in D.C. today, I think. I don't know where he is, actually. He's out flying around somewhere, you know.
Oh, I thought he was, you know, hanging with Obama.
He could be. I don't know. Who knows? Pete leads a very interesting life. And he says, I was wondering if now, after you've been using a Drobo for some time, what's your opinion on it? And if you are using the Drobo Share, that too. I'm thinking of getting one for the office of 10 network users running from an Intel Xserve for purely Time Machine use. The Drobo will potentially sit in the same cabinet as the Xserve and would not necessarily need the Drobo Share. This may be a silly question, but if you take a drive out of the Drobo and that has not failed, can it be put in a drive caddy connected to another drive and accessed, or will the Beyond RAID formatting on it stop this? Okay, answering the second question first, no, you can't take a drive out of the Drobo and access it any other way. It is Drobo only. The good news is you could take one drive out and put another drive in, and your data will remain intact. Going back to the first question, I love my Drobo. In your instance, I would not recommend the Drobo Share. And that is for two reasons. One, you've already got the Xserve sitting right there. There's no reason to use a Drobo Share. And number two, network access to the Drobo is faster via a Mac than it is going to be with the Drobo Share. The Drobo Share had some pretty significant limitations just in its networking protocols. It had nothing to do with the interface on it or anything. It was just the networking of the thing. I think we saw it max out. I don't have the numbers right in front of me here, but it was maybe, you know, half. Let's see. Drobo Share. I do have the numbers right in front of me. Drobo Share was 13 megabytes a second. FireWire 800, 33 megabytes a second. And that's going over the network. So you definitely, no reason to use the Drobo Share for what you're doing there, Mark. Lastly, I love it. I think it's great. It, you know, for what you're talking about doing, some people think that having backups that are stored redundantly with RAID is a good thing. I think that's a little overkill, personally, but if, you know, if your tolerance is such that you feel like you need a RAID array to which to send your backups, then the Drobo is an easy way to do that. And you can expand it, just by adding drives. But, you know, for me, I don't use it for backups as much as I do archiving things where, you know, I'm going to store one copy of a piece of data, and I want to be sure that it's, you know, fault tolerant. So that's what I use it for. But yeah, I love it.
Drives. I got a new drive.
What'd you get?
So I was at a couple of shows, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But actually what I picked up, because I saw it again, and just the form factor I really liked, and it's not terribly expensive. So right now my MacBook, of course, backs up on a time capsule, but I also want to have a portable external drive. And I have an older FireWire 400 drive that's only like 80 gigs, so it's not big enough. You know, it's still good for carrying files around, and it's an old case. I think I got it from OWC. You know, it's transparent. You can see the drive. It looks kind of cool. But I saw this drive again, and so I decided to pick one of these up, an iOmega Ego triple interface.
Yeah.
Half terabyte drive. And it was like $100-something. I mean.
Cool.
You know, so, and supposedly I won't need a power cord. I have had external drives, though. They're older units that, you know, required something. I think these guys include a magic cable that will give it enough juice if your computer doesn't provide it. But I think these drives are pretty efficient. So, you know, 500 gigs. And it also has, you know, an amazing, they claim that you can drop it from a height of, I forget what it is, and you won't hurt things, but I'm not going to explore that. Of course, shortly afterwards, I mentioned this, our friends at OWC said, dude, we got a quad interface drive. I think they recently introduced the product, which is an enclosure that has not only FireWire and USB, but also eSATA.
Right.
But it's more, I think, for a desktop. That I wanted something here, which is like shirt pocket, which this is.
Right. So, right.
So it's coming.
Cool. Well, that's cool. So you're going to put a lot of sensitive data on it, remove it from everywhere else, and then, you know, throw the drive from the top of your house down to the sidewalk, right?
Yeah.
Good. Perfect. That's excellent.
I'll give you a copy first, just in case.
Oh, no, that'd be too much. Come on. You know,
things go bad.
You're ruining the fun of it all, right?
Yeah. So what else we got here? We got Mike?
Yeah, we should talk about this TiVo thing, because this is definitely, you know, a Mac-related TiVo question. So,
Is it?
It is. Okay. Definitely. Definitely.
Hi, John and Dave. It's Mike from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Thanks very much for doing the Mac Geek Gab. I listen to it every week, and it is wonderful. So my problem is, I have a Series 3 TiVo DVR, and I regularly transfer things that I've recorded from the TiVo to my MacBook Pro, which is very slow, and I attribute that to the TiVo network adapter, which I think is not particularly fast. So then once I get them over to my Mac, then what I need to do is I need to encode those in MPEG-4, which takes about 3 hours for a two-hour soccer game, for instance. And then I transfer them over to my iDisk and share them so that my son, who's going to college in Florida, can download the games and watch them because he does not have cable at school. And that takes another 3 hours. So to watch a game that has two 45-minute halves, it takes 9 hours to get it from point A, my TiVo, to point C, my iDisk. And I was wondering if there is any other way to do this quicker. I appreciate any help. This is where you cut me off.
And consider yourself cut off. All right, so this is very much Mac-related, right, John? So there's three bottlenecks.
Parts of it.
Yeah, there's three bottlenecks here, right? There's transferring from his TiVo to his Mac. There's the conversion on his Mac, right?
If you choose to do so, because you can take the file out of the TiVo and just play it, though it's monstrously huge.
Right, so he needs to compress it, otherwise the upload would be, you know, monumental.
Eternal.
Yeah, right, eternal, right.
And then the third is transfer...
uploading, right.
...to iDisk. So, you know, let's start with the beginning, and I actually, if I could start off.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I suspected, so I thought, well, you know, to me, here's the obvious problem. If you look at what the TiVo is connected to, right now, TiVo officially supports 802.11G, which is 54 megabits in theory.
Right.
But there's also a hardwired port. Now, I don't know if it's 100 or 1000 base T. I'm going to guess it's at least 100.
Okay.
So I don't know because I've never used it. And actually, you know what I want to get someday is one of those power line adapters and hook it to the TiVo so I can get better throughput than the wireless adapter.
Oh. Because
I suspect I'll get more, even if it's 100 base T. So 100 base T, 100 megabits versus 54 of the wireless adapter, unless if the power line thing can keep up with it.
Yep.
So that would be my recommendation. If you're at all doing something that takes a lot of time, like I don't do a lot of this. If I did, I think I would hardwire the TiVo. So that's one bottleneck.
Yeah.
It can be. Well, though, I think as you're going to suggest, the TiVo may not be network bound.
No, I don't. Well, it's possible that in his case,
talk about choke points. Well, he had a three, didn't he? I think Series 3 is the first HD one, which is the one I have. And I think the one you have, right?
Correct. Now, the Series 3 is the fastest TiVo that exists, especially in terms of its ability to send data over the network. But the TiVo's processor is very slow compared to the computers that we all use. And, network traffic is not prioritized, especially outbound network traffic. So even on a 100 megabit network, you may not see, or even on a gigabit network, you may not see any noticeable speed improvement over, over your Wi-Fi. However, you know, if your Mac is on Wi-Fi and your TiVo's on Wi-Fi, then you've got Wi-Fi, you know, congestion stuff happening too. And so it might help, but don't expect that is going to be a monumental change.
That surprises me that it's that wimpy. Then again, I think there is a special, what does the TiVo do? Video, duh. So I believe there is a pretty nice MPEG encoder decoder in there.
That's right.
Yeah, so I'm with you. They may have a, I don't know, 100 megahertz or maybe not that wimpy.
Yeah, but
as far as but I think it's some sort of Linux, you know, probably low-end processor, which to move the bits around to make the thing work is good enough. But yeah, not for yeah, that's a good point. You know, I'd like to benchmark that sometime.
Yeah, it will bring a tear to your eye because it's slow.
Okay.
So
they had to focus on what's important, which is video.
That's right.
Networking.
So try, you know, if you can hardwire into it, it's not going to be any slower, and it might in fact be faster. Because I've gotten decent, you know, compared to other TiVos, I've gotten decent speeds out of the Series 3. However, you know, I'm looking at this and listening to his message thinking, wow, he's transferring the data and then he's converting the data and then he's transferring the converted file. What if we can consolidate these things, right? If the TiVo transfers slowly, well, the computer is just sitting there essentially idling, waiting for that file to arrive. What if we could convert while we're transferring, right? Why not use the processor while it's coming in? And hey, could we take the file that we're generating and start uploading that right away, right? Why wait until it's 100% complete to start sending it up? And
no,
I think I have the answer. It's called iTiVo, and it's at itivo.sourceforge.net, I think is. Oh, no, it's one of those Google code projects now. So it's code.google.com/p/iTiVo. And of course, we'll put a link in the show notes. And it is built to do exactly what Mike is asking for here. So it will download from your TiVo and convert on the fly. And there's no reason that you couldn't have it saved to your iDisk or even a Dropbox, right? Which will, if you have it set to sync automatically, it's going to start syncing that file up to the cloud right away, right? You don't have to wait, you know, as the file builds, it's going to build it and you know, hopefully do it in slices, but I don't know. Maybe you do have to wait until it's completed, but I would certainly try it and see what happens in terms of sending it up to the cloud from there. And iDisk might not be the right answer. It might be another thing to try would be Dropbox, which, you know, you can sign up for a 2 gig Dropbox for free. just to give it a shot. But it will, iTiVo will convert it into MPEG-4 for you. And they've even got presets for, you know, the iPhone and iPod and Apple TV. So whatever, you know, whatever you want to slurp it down to, you can do that. So that's the magic answer here, I think. And it, of course, the beautiful part is it's free and it works with Snow Leopard. I just tried it the other day.
Yeah, it's a magic answer. I'm going to offer another alternative,
yeah,
which I've used in the past when I've gotten, because yeah, when you use something like, so a couple of utilities, TiVo Decode Manager, I think
yep.
it is.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's what it's called, because some of the files have some annoying DRM on them. So this gets rid of that. And it downloads it pretty much, you know, I'm going to have to look at that, because I do seem to remember the speeds were not the maximum speed of my wireless, but they were a bit slow. So back to your point.
Yeah.
But anyways, there's something called FFmpeg X or 10, FFmpeg yeah. 10. I guess we'll say that. But it's basically a nice Mac front end to a bunch of Unix converters. And what you can do a lot of times is take one of those large files. And a lot of times if you either, it'll in, you know, pretty much real time, I think. It'll, you know, take as long, and I know he wants to avoid this, but sometimes it may solve another problem, in that if you want to downsample something, so it's not full HD, for example.
Right.
You want to make it smaller resolution or less frames per second or reduce the quality of the audio track. You may not need, you know, the audio, I think, is often not what you really care about in this case. It would be the video, but I've done this before. I've taken videos that have come out at 100 of megabytes, put it through FFmpeg 10, and once it's out of that, it's much smaller. It's still viewable. And if you're talking, you know, transfer times, if you can reduce it by half or a quarter, which sometimes it does with this, that's another thing. But I definitely like, you know, of course, the parallel strategy, which is.
Well, okay. You know, so it's important to note that Mike's already doing that. Now, I don't know what he's using, but he's converting it down to MPEG-4, which is not the MPEG-2 that it sits on the TiVo. So I had sort of assumed that Mike was already, you know, crunching it down. It's important to note, though, that iTiVo uses the TiVo Decode backend. Also uses the FFmpeg backend, and that's what it uses to do its work. And it also uses mEncoder, which is the thing that kind of deals with the TiVo proprietary stuff, if you will. So iTiVo uses all of that stuff. It's just its own front end to it, and does it all in one package. Yeah, you should totally check it out, man. It's the way to go. Once I stumbled onto this, I thought, well, okay, I'm done with all this other muckety muck. This is, you know, it's just wrapped into one package and it does it all. So,
yeah, look at that. But yeah. FFmpeg is good for just general video conversion.
Absolutely.
From into. I found it, yeah, invaluable. Either for, yeah, making something smaller, but still of, you know, enough quality that people can watch it.
Right.
Because you don't have a big pipe. And that's still... Yeah, it's still a problem.
Oh yeah,
that's your uploads.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so John, you went to a couple of shows this week, and maybe you can tell us all about it there, John.
So two shows I went to during the week: Showstoppers and Holiday Spectacular. So I saw that these are holiday shows. I know, don't roll your eyes, saying, "Oh my gosh, it's not even, you know." Whenever, October, yeah, this is the point, is to kind of see, you know, get an up close look here. So they're different events. Showstopper is a little smaller, more intimate. You can, you know, usually get more FaceTime. And Holiday Spectacular is kind of tough to cover. You know, it's a bit larger. So anyways, and both of them have, you know, fine food and drink and lots of giveaways. So here are the things that caught my eye is cool stuff. And I'm just going to go through them. So at Showstoppers, Escort has something nice. It's a personal GPS tracker for your vehicle, or I guess anything really, but I think the intent is a vehicle, and they have a combined with a web service, so there's no you know, dependency on any platform. One of them, they go for about $350 to $400. One of them has a little key fob, which I guess you can use to activate and deactivate it, but you can do everything on the web. And actually you can also pay a third party. I didn't get all the details yet. We'll link to it, but to actually look and notice if your vehicle is doing something unusual, like leaving, you know, from work when you're still there or something like that. And it'll text you, it'll call you, stuff like that. I offered that you could, you know, plant it on your kid or whatever, but you know, that's kind of unlikely because they are a bit large, but you know, covertly hidden in your car, very cool. So I think I may get one of these just for fun. Actually, I wish someone would steal my car so I can get a new one. Okay, next, Mogo Talk, a Bluetooth headset that's integrated into an iPhone case. Kind of neat. $129.99. I think it charges off the iPhone, or if not, it will be doing that soon. So that I thought was cool. Kingston showed a Data Traveler Vault Privacy 16 gig thumb drive. So they're getting larger.
Wow.
It's about $300. And I did find online a 32 gig version of that drive, and that'll set you back $1,000.
Wow.
So people are making them. They're getting bigger. 16 gigs. I don't think I have a 16 gig one. I think
Big.
A couple of gigs.
Yeah.
So that's nice. And it also has, as I mentioned, the privacy. So that's kind of cool. Holiday Spectacular. They had some things. Griffin recently introduced something called My Phones. It's headphones for the wee ones. One nice thing is it has a volume limiting thing. It limits it to 85 dB so they don't blast out their little eardrums.
Yeah.
I still got to say, man, some people I see in public, if I can hear your music and you got earphones, you're going to go deaf, dude.
Well, I will qualify
unless you
that
have
statement.
Poorly in it, most cases, if I can hear it from, you know, a relatively short distance, I don't know.
If they're earbuds, no question about it.
If they're headphones, okay.
It depends on the style of headphone, because some are built as open air headphones, and so sound will get in, but also, of course, get out, and it those bleed obviously
right.
A lot more than you'd get from you know, a sealed system. But yeah. You're right. Yeah.
To me, it's people that have things that are just in their ear, not over their ear.
Correct.
So, yeah, I think we're making a difference here.
Yeah.
But these are nice. They're and they also have shells that you know, with different, you know, interesting patterns on. I guess they have a blank one where the kids can color in their own, and that's kind of neat. And they're I think $40.
Huh. Cool.
What is this? Oh, okay, this is cool, man. I got to get one of these. V holder, so it's capital V, small hold R, 1200 contour HD camera. What is it? It's an HD camera that you put on your helmet or on your head somehow, and it's $300. It does HD quality video, 720, I think.
Whoa.
But that's HD technically. It has a micro SD memory card. I think it can run up to 8 hours. Huh. Okay. Or you can fit 8 hours. And I guess it has a battery in it. And it outputs a movie in QuickTime format. But the cool part, you know, I've never seen something quite like this before, but yeah, you literally, you know, either they have, I guess, special headgear, or if you have a bike helmet or something like that, but they were showing people doing rollerblading and skating and riding a bicycle, you know, motorcycles, you know, sky gliding. It's pretty cool.
Wow. And so the camera, because I'm looking at a picture of it here on the vholdr.com website, and it's a tiny little, it's a barrel size camera. It's sort of like the original iSight, right? It looks to be about that size.
Very similar size.
Okay. Yeah. So, but it's got its own memory. I mean, it's all self-contained, right? It
takes,
can record video internally, and that's that.
Yes. It takes a micro SD card, which you may have seen this.
Yep.
So
tiny little thing. Yeah.
Yeah. They only go up to maybe, I forget the maximum size right
okay.
now.
Okay. Oh, that's pretty cool.
That's the only limiting thing, is that those are very small memory cards. They have them in a lot of cell phones, but again, I forget. But look at it. I mean, it's cool, man.
It looks cool.
Imagine if,
yeah,
you know, you're riding the horse, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Dude, that would be so cool.
I could mount this on my drums. I've always told people, you know, it's a very different view from stage. Than it is in the crowd.
Yeah, spotlights, right?
Well, and you just, no, you know, it's interesting. People, I think this is sort of a universal thing. People see the stage as though it's almost like they're watching TV, right? They don't realize, it doesn't dawn on them that the people on stage can see you. You know, so people get a whole lot freer when they're facing the stage versus, you know, if they were to turn around, I think they would act a whole lot differently than, you know, they think that there's this thing and it's a wall that you just can't see. So without getting too deep into it, over the last, you know, 20 years of playing gigs or whatever, I've seen some very interesting things happen in the crowd that I've been able to see from on stage. And maybe actually now that I say this, it's probably better that I haven't had a camera to share these moments with anyone. So we'll just leave it at that.
I guess I I'd say the other reason is because they're tanked, but.
Oh, that helps. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that helps, certainly. But even still, I think there's some, it's interesting. People, you know, it's as though the band isn't paying attention. And sometimes you're not, but sometimes you are. So,
right.
That's cool.
Okay.
Though. All right. Moving on.
Couple more things. Going to wrap it up here. One or two more things. Oh, hold on. I got to find this here. There we go. So 3M updated one of their products. At the last show I went to, they had a small projector about the size of a deck of cards, but they had a shroud over it, and it wasn't very bright. Well, they introduced an updated version of it, and actually now that they've improved the LED technology, they didn't have a shroud or like a dark room you walked into to see it. It was operating in a place that had the, you know, kind of harsh lights at the top there. So I don't have a price immediately, but it's the 3M Pro 120. I think it was 3 something. And actually, you could probably, you know, 3M Pro 120. Let's look here and see if we can find someone. M Pro 120.
Yep.
Yeah, M Pro 120. Let's see.
Yeah, you talked about this last time. Yeah.
But it was only the 100, so it was dimmer. This one just, okay, you know, has... It's just gotten better.
Sure.
So I think it's more viable because a lot of the early portable projectors, you know, we saw another one too that used lasers, and I'm not sure where they're at right now. But yeah, sometimes these things, current projectors, man, I mean, they're a pain in the neck to use a lot of times. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
And they get very hot. And if the fan goes off, your bulb is toast.
Right.
They get extremely hot. These things, I don't think, have that problem, but they're, you know, not using, you know, blindingly bright lights. Anyways,
cool.
Fujifilm introduced an instant camera. Kind of interesting. Remember, like Polaroid?
Yeah.
I asked them, and they're not using any of the IP, but it's the same model. The camera looked like a fairly decent camera. $50 for the camera, and so it's, you know, it's the razor and the blades deal. So the camera's $50. It's a fairly decent camera. You know, you'll see a picture of it. They took some pictures. I think the upload quality was good. And it's about, I looked online, and a pack that has 20 pictures in it is about $16. So
like you said, the razor and the blades.
There you go.
Yep.
If you want instant gratification and something to hold on to, then I think it's great. But you know, I never personally really got into the film thing, just because I didn't want to, you know, waste a lot of resources experimenting or learning how to use the camera.
Yeah.
So, but this thing I think does, for what it is, I think
that's cool. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was those two shows. I'll dig through my notes and stuff. I'm getting a few gimmies, you know, as all these shows are about.
Sure.
Some headsets and some other toys. So I think we're all going to, you know, as different holidays approach, you know, have suggestions on
cool.
On what you may want. So I think that's it.
That'll do it, huh?
Oh,
all right.
Man, yeah, they're kind of chilly out there.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Tonight it's actually a little warmer. We've had fires in the fireplace the last couple of nights. Not that we've needed them, but, you know, we like to have fires, so it's it's fun. All right. The one thing we haven't gone through is contact info. How do you reach us? And I'll tell you how. You can call in on the phone, 206-666-GEEK-4335, right? Is that right, John? 4335, right?
Last I checked.
All right. And you can email us. And John, the email address is?
Well, I'd probably try feedback@macgeekgab.com. Now, remember, that's feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Not backfeed, and certainly not backfeet, but feedback. At Backbeat Media. No, feedback at MacGeekGab.com. Can you tell I've had a crazy day?
See, that's why I keep saying it.
You have to keep saying it. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
Well, right. You're busy enough growing that whole empire there. You're just adding sites right and left. My goodness, I can't keep track anymore.
I can say it here. The deal was signed Friday, and we'll issue a press release this week. But we've added 3 sites lately to Backbeat Media. We added I Use This, which you knew about, and that's actually very exciting to have them on board. They're a great site. We've talked about it on this show before, even.
They're an awesome platform, and they have, you know, associated software, of course, which Yeah, it's like you have a community of people and everybody keeps everybody up to date as to the latest version.
Exactly.
It's really nice.
And we expanded our iPhone niche by adding iPhoneincanada.ca, which actually has quite a large number of U.S. Readers as well. And they do a great job over there, and they've kind of got their own little niche. So it's a really nice addition to our and a nice complement to that side of our family of sites. And then just on Friday, and we'll start working with them this week. Believe it or not, we added MacWorldExpo.com, and so Backbeat Media will be selling the web space there for this season, and we're really excited about that. We're looking forward to seeing where that can go. It should be an interesting, very interesting site to represent, and I look forward to seeing how people respond to it. So.
Yeah, that's coming up, but there's what else? Skype.
Skype. You can Skype us. That's right. Now that we're back on track here. Skype too, Mac Geek Gab, and I tested it today. It works. I try to test that every now and again, but if you try it and you have a problem, email us and let us know, but it should work. Skype to Mac Geek Gab. And you can always leave us iTunes comments, and that's that. Now, John, you and I are going to be at Blog World Expo next month, just like 3 weeks away, or maybe even less than 3 weeks away, out in Vegas. Yep. Tonight, unfortunately, ends the early bird rates, but you've got a couple more hours, maybe 5 hours if they let you go till Pacific time from right now. But yeah, this show's not going to be out for another 30 minutes, so you've got 4.5 hours. And if you just listen to the show now, you only have 3.5 hours. So chances are, right, that's right. But either way, whether you get in before the early bird expires or after, Observer VIP in all caps will get you 20% off whatever ticket you're buying. So, and that's October 15th through 17th out in Las Vegas. iPhoneAlley.com, another site that's a proud member of the Backbeat Media family of sites. Michael Johnston, he converts this show to AAC for you, and he runs iPhone Alley and their podcast over there. And we've been ecstatic to be working with him basically since the day he started his site. So that's been a key factor in our iPhone representation there.
I remember when he was a weed podcaster.
Cashfly, Michael's doing a great job with everything he's doing. Cashfly Absolutely. Hosting at cashfly.com and cashfly.net provides all the bandwidth for us. The podcast marketplace this month includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo 2 from Barebone Software, Text Expander and Text Expander Touch from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Pathfinder 5 from Cocotec. Again, all through that other piece of the empire, as you like to call it, John, the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And that's it. It's time to go. We get to watch fall TV. I think House is on tonight.
Heroes.
Oh, yeah. We still haven't gotten into that
show. And last week, this show still weirds me out. Fringe.
Oh, that's a great show.
The first... first 5 minutes of that is... What the...
Have fun. We'll see you next week. And don't get caught.
Made up.